Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we are recording with Zoom since we are all inside for the pandemic. And today we're going to talk about Emma and The Way Back. These are two movies that you can probably find. I've noticed you can find a lot of movies that are, you know, were recently in the theater or would be in the theater if you're willing to pay for them on Amazon Prime. So you can still go to the movies while being at home. So let's start with Emma. Where do you want to start with Emma, Mike?
Well, just a general observation that it's based on an 1815 novel by Jane Austen. And Jane Austen is such, I'm not just a great writer, it goes without saying, but from a filmmaking perspective, she's always there as a source. I mean, a handful of novels, but how often they've been made and remade, right? I mean, think about great material like that, which again speaks to her period, her, you know, early 19th century setting. But of course, every time you get a new version of Emma or one of the other Austen novels, it speaks also to the sensibility of the age that's making it. So just a quick reminder with Emma, you can go back to an earlier version. This version that we're watching stars Anya Taylor-Joy, so she's the star of this most recent Emma, but you can go back some years and you have Gwyneth Paltrow, who played the title role. And then by way of literal updates of it, we all remember Clueless from 1995 with Alicia Silverstone. So again, there's something really kind of timeless with the material itself in terms of issues that women face, specifically in terms of romance. But it's sort of quirky in the sense that in some ways timeless in terms of young women and those romantic concerns, but in other ways time-bound, isn't it? Because, I mean, certainly Austen was such a keen observer of her own period in terms of etiquette, in terms of manners, and so on. So maybe we can launch into it that way by way of how Emma is actually presented in the film as a character, and then, of course, for the film's director, herself a woman, you know, the way in which it's packaged, if you will, in terms of period decor and general setting.
You know, Emma's, like, almost considered second string Jane Austen, because the first ones you always do are Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility. And then, okay, well, we'll do Emma. So we haven't had as many versions of Emma. I think most people remember the Gwyneth Paltrow one. And of course,
yeah, they do.
Clueless. But this isn't a Jane Austen that most people are familiar with.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's simply, I mean, you're essentially right in the sense that things like Pride and Prejudice, you know, get made more often. But the fact that with Emma, there have been at least a few versions of it. In other words, it is sort of second-tier Austen, but second-tier Austen would be first-tier for almost any other writer, you know? And I think sometimes it's because people don't always respond quite as well to the character of Emma. I mean, I'm speculating on this a bit, that, you know, like Elizabeth Bennet, you know, characters like that, that you just, you know, if you're a teenaged reader or an adult reader for that matter, you really glom onto, you really latch onto characters like that. I have a feeling that some readers and some viewers maybe not be as immediately or as completely taken in by Emma as a character. What do you think?
Yeah, she is hard. She's harder to like because she's more independent, not that Elizabeth Bennet isn't independent. I mean, that's part of why you like her. But she's manipulative and very openly so. For, you know, decent reasons, but you still, you know, you sort of look at her as scheming.
Yes, thank you for saying that. And in fact, I had two very brief quotes from Jane Austen herself about the character of Emma, and I think they really help to describe her. Now, bear in mind, Emma is 21, and so she's, you know, entering into womanhood and you know, potentially is getting to the point where she should be marriage-minded. Certainly in their society, everyone was obsessed or fixated on that point. But in terms of her personality traits, Austen writes of Emma that she's, quote, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, close quote. Now, you would think, well, those are nice traits, but when you think about it, that maybe she is, you know, so well situated that way that, you know, it's one thing to be comfortable, maybe something else to be like a little too comfortable, you know, or clever, but maybe a little too clever. And so that's where I think segues into the kind of scheming you were talking about, that she's kind of full of herself to some extent, or fuller of herself than maybe some of the other Austen characters. And the second quote from Austen is, in fact, is directly to that point. This is what Austen writes about Emma, quote, a disposition to think a little too well of herself, close quote. And I think that's one reason why, or one of the reasons why audiences, whether in book form or cinematic form, might find Emma a little too full of herself, a little kind of snooty and scheming and not as immediately likable. I mean, is that sort of congruent with what you were saying?
Yeah, and it isn't until you get fairly well into the book or the film that you start to come around to liking her.
Yeah. You know what? It's an interesting transition when you said, you know, you have to get a bit further into the book or into the film before you start liking her. I agree with you completely. And I thought that the film, and I basically liked the film, but one of my reservations is it took me a while to get into the film. And here's why specifically. The director of it, Autumn de Wilde, presents the initial scenes almost in a sort of an English equivalent of a Hallmark card or something, that pretty images and, you know, in terms of Regency England, you get some of the shades of, you know, a pea green, a dusky pink. I mean, you know, the palette there is art historically and architecturally and costume-wise appropriate to the period, but in an almost overstated, kind of exaggerated way where it seems like the film itself becomes a triumph of art direction, and that's not meant as a compliment here, where you feel like it's art directed to within an inch of its life, right? So all these really pretty pastoral scenes early on, which really, you know, it's eye candy, right? And I'm enjoying eye candy too, but there's quality, and it has a word that I love to use as a put-down, that there's a twee quality to it. In other words, it just seems a little precious, it's decorative, but maybe like, you know, a little too pretty in some ways. And I just feel like it's verging on being superficial that way, beyond what some of the characters should be, even that the film itself is being kind of pretty in a superficial way. And for me, for about the first half hour, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be sitting here for hours, you know, looking at that pretty picture postcard with characters walking across the lawn. And you know what I mean? It was almost like a Merchant Ivory film in a pejorative sense, you know, that I thought this is going to be like, yeah, easy on the eyes, but also easy on the mind. But what happened within about I can't clock it exactly, but within a half hour or so, I felt like as the story got more involved, the filmmaking itself became more nuanced and got toned down a little bit, and I felt like I could be pulled more into character and plot and less carried along just on the eye candy appeal of, you know, great old houses on beautiful estates. What do you think?
Well, I think I agree with you, and I think one of the reasons, unfortunately, is that one of my favorite actors, Bill Nighy, yeah, I think contributes to that twee quality where he's always Bill Nighy. But it's a discordant note.
Well, Bill Nye is really such an endearing actor, but the way he's used in this film, he plays Emma's father, and he's meant to be a comical character. They live on this country estate, which is about 16 miles outside of London, so they're really removed from the city itself that way. And so he's that kind of country gentleman who's, you know, an English eccentric, like that's something novel in English society, but that kind of quirky, rich character. But the way the film handles him is it periodically, like, pops in on him. What I mean is he does not actually have a lot of screen time, but every so often there'll be a scene where, you know, whether it's Emma talking to him or just him with the servants or whatever, where it pops in, and it's like that sort of reliable comic relief, or just not like ha-ha-ha comic relief, but more a matter of droll or, you know, kind of
I was just going to say droll.
Yeah, droll's the word, where it's not like slap your knees, you know, funny that way. It's more of the kind of drollery. But for me, it just seemed there for a while that was kind of formulaic, and it didn't really do much for him as a character. You don't really know him beyond the immediate laughter or smile from a scene like that. And it seemed almost like filler in the sense that, well, you'll have a scene involving Emma and her, you know, lady friends or potential boyfriends, and then you have a scene involving the father, the Bill Nighy character, and like, you know, almost like with a metronome, where every so often they'll pop in another scene with Bill Nighy, and I found it kind of distracting in a way. It just seemed like it wasn't really taking me deeper into the story. It was just kind of in a predictable way, saying, okay, well, now we'll have another funny scene with Bill Nighy.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't seem to fit with everything else. It's time for Bill Nighy to show up and say something, you know, witty and snarky.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I do think, I like what you said about the Merchant Ivory tone to it. I thought with the, you know, cards that came in every now and then to tell you it was now spring or summer or what season it was, reminded me a little of The Favorite.
Yeah.
And that sort of mood of, you know, we're playing it straight, but really, some of the stuff we're talking about is hilarious. And then they would do a pretty good job with that, with scenes like, you know, they're all sitting around waiting, you know, for Jane to play the piano, and they don't like her. And so they're, you know, acting, well, she's never going to outplay you, Emma. And then she sits down and, you know, blows it away. And the start that you see the characters do is hilarious, because you see them just sort of being shown up for being the snobs that they are. And by the way, everybody in this film is actually playing the piano and singing the songs. This isn't, you know, professionals that they got in, people dubbing. These are people actually performing, and I was very impressed with the music in the movie.
I was really likewise impressed there because, you know, we all laugh about Hollywood films we've seen where somebody who's not a professional musician, but sort of like a parlor musician, you know, at a family soiree or at some dinner party, whatever, sits down at the piano and suddenly they're playing like Vladimir Horowitz, right? And I think, oh my goodness, you should be in Carnegie Hall, not in your living room, right? And then the fact that, you know, that usually it might well be Vladimir Horowitz on the soundtrack, you know, and you get the usual, if you have the fingers on the keyboard, well, those are stunt fingers, right? You know, and all the ways in which that can be missed. But anyway, to cut to the chase on this, how often in movies, people who really are not meant to be like star performers really play like complete professionals. And I really appreciate a film like this one where you realize, well, in the early 19th century and certainly beyond that, you know, every respectable house would have had the piano in the parlor, would have had instruments, and the family members and guests and all would have sat around after dinner and, you know, in the music room, and they would have performed. And they weren't all, you know, professional caliber musicians, but they were good enough, you know, good enough amateurs, if you will. And of course, the origins of the word amateur, you know, there's something you love, something you do because you love it. And that's the spirit I appreciate, where it would be okay for somebody to even hit a wrong note, you know what I mean, or for a voice to crack or something. I mean, you know, real human beings, real families can enjoy music making like that, and don't, you know, they don't want to walk, they're not going to walk out of the living room demanding a refund, right? You know, they'll say, well, that's Aunt so-and-so and her voice might be a little high, but she loves the material. So what I'm getting at there is exactly your point, that this is a film where you had a sense of plausibility, you had a sense that, you know, these are people sitting down to play, and they were good. I mean, it was fine that way, but you didn't feel like you were being blown away, and you're kind of thankful actually that you weren't, you know, that it wasn't like hold your breath, great music making.
Right, but you certainly don't expect Jane Fairfax to be able to play like that. So, nice moment.
Well, we're still talking about it around town. But see, that music making really is important because this is a film, as in so much of Jane Austen, where you have the female protagonist, and then you have a relatively small cast or group of the intimates by way of, you know, a girlfriend or a family member or whatever, and that kind of interplay there, you know, lends itself to, certainly in filmic terms, having literal interplay, you know what I mean? Like, you know, somebody at the keyboard, somebody at the piano, people listening, and you know, and there's not just the music being played, it's also the looks being exchanged around the room, and things that work well in a novel, but arguably work even better in a film, because you're hearing the music, and you're watching the performer, and you're also watching the other people in the room as they watch the performer, as they watch each other. I mean, that's part of the theater experience, you know, that music making, like you know, going to the opera or going to the symphony, you're looking at other people around you as much as you are, you know, listening to the music coming from the stage.
So when they were casting this, every actress named Emma was unavailable to do the movie. So I take from that that they asked Emma Thompson and Emma Stone and all the other Emmas. It's interesting to me that they would think that that would be important. But let's try to get a real Emma. The actress that they did get is able to do a nosebleed on command.
Not everyone can do that.
Not everybody can do that.
No, I'm trying right now and I can't. But Anya Taylor-Joy, I think she's fine. I mean,
I think she's fine too.
I mean, in terms of the physical casting, in terms of the acting ability, I mean, she really slips right into that role, you know, and I was, you know, quite moved by that, the fact that, you know, when the character is meant to be flighty or superficial, she can do that, but as an actor, she's got enough chops that you realize, well, you know, ultimately, we're meant to like Emma a bit more, and you know, you can't mandate that in a script at a certain, well, you can, but you can't really carry it off completely unless you have an actor who, with the acting chops to do it, and I would say that Anya Taylor-Joy's got the chops.
I thought Johnny Flynn did a good job as Mr. Knightley.
Oh, yeah.
He was actually, I thought, a surprise.
Yeah, I really enjoyed every scene he was in. And I don't want to say he stole the picture because that wouldn't be fair to when the film works as well as it does. But let's just put it this way. He was a welcome presence, right? When he was in a scene, you could see the intelligence in the actor's face, you know, as he played that part.
Yeah, and he did a good job of convincing us that for a while he was hoping to, you know, be the person to show Emma how shallow she was, only to, you know, develop feelings for her. I thought the whole performance was very believable.
And actually, that's one reason why the second half of the film works better, because exactly what you just mentioned, you start to feel there that she might have a little more substance than we initially gave her credit for, or more substance than she deserved early on. But in any event, by the end of the film, you feel that she's got a little more going for her, she's got a little more substance, and then correspondingly that you could see why Mr. Knightley would be drawn to her and why he should, be ultimately the one to get her. It's just in the sense that she has more substance than we initially thought or than she initially had. And then, as I say, likewise, that Mr. Knightley has the perception, let's put it that way, that the powers of perception to realize that, she's somebody who is worth courting, who should be courted.
So if they're going to make Emma yet again, what are they going to have to do to top this one?
Well, this is where, I think I'd let a few years go by at least, because there are some other Austen novels you could revisit. With this particular one, I'm not exactly looking to have another Emma in 2 or 3 years, but who could put a number on this? But let's say 8 years, 10 years from now, it's the point at which there might be a young actress who's really well suited for it, or they might decide to work the material or rework it. I mean, again, think of a Clueless-type film where, in an extreme fashion, you actually, do reset it in a different time period, almost the way Shakespeare would be, placed on an ocean liner in the 1920s or something. Then that's one way to approach it. And then secondly, even in terms of whatever our societal mores, our standards are in a given era, an Emma that we are watching now, the Emma we're talking about now, might be presented a bit differently 10 years from now. That's, got to be conjecture on our part as to what we expect or want from an Emma.
Well, what's interesting is that most of the movies or books of Jane Austen that people like, you're rooting for the underdog. You're rooting for the woman whose role in the book or the story is to be Cinderella. She needs to make a good marriage because that's the way things were then. But in Emma, she's already got money. She doesn't have to do that. So they focus on something else, which is her trying to play matchmaker for her friends and, order society to her liking. And that is a different kind of person to feel sympathy for.
Yeah, it gets back to your earlier point about that conniving, that scheming quality, that she's really manipulative. And when you think about her friends, she treats them like pieces on a game board, that she's going to match this one up with that one and this and that. And I think, maybe you should, ask them what they want or have a real conversation. Instead, you can always see the wheels turning in her head where she's trying to get the world to correspond to what she wants it to be there, and not just her immediate world but their world. I mean, how she wants people partnered or paired off that way. So that's one reason why she's not terribly sympathetic or terribly she's deep early on only in a sense of deeply plotting, right, but not really deep in terms of ethics or consideration for others. And that's, again, doubling back on our earlier point in terms of why she's not as likable. And then related to that, the quote I gave from Austen, the fact that she is comfortable, the fact that she's rich, I mean, she's basically set right now. There are other young women who need to marry well. Either they need to, or at least the family perceives that they need to. There are those pressures that way that you need to find a wealthy young man. That's not really the case with her. You're absolutely right. I mean, she's well off. She's not, either feeling pressured herself or feeling family pressure that she has to somehow get a handsome and wealthy beau.
One thing that did occur to me when I was watching it is how this particular story can be remade with contemporary situations, where the other Jane Austen stories, where the story is that, you've got to find somebody to get married, it seems a little old-fashioned. It did occur to me when I was watching it, because these movies always have, the scene at the dance, where everyone is at the dance and everyone dances. And of course, we don't have that anymore. So I thought how interesting this looks when you pair it with, the prom, or even the way people will dance at their wedding in a way that they never do. It's not like you do that all the time when you're dating and then you do it when you get married in a fancier environment. You don't do it at all. But you reenact this sort of scene from a Jane Austen movie.
Well, in terms of the social rituals of that period.
And the clubs.
In that era, the importance of a dance there in terms of who went, how they were partnered, how they were dressed, and so on. And the dances themselves, of course, were just as ritualized, just as stylized, right? I mean, everything, to the letter that way. And then, in terms of how, as an audience, we kind of watch it with a demographer's eye. In other words, we're really looking at those you know, like what level are they swimming in the fishbowl, that kind of a thing. And a dance makes that, you know, something on a stage, in effect, where you really see how people are presented or how they present themselves in society. But then in terms of like moving towards a happy resolution, it's not coincidental that when you think about Shakespeare's comedies, how often, and they have their share of matchmaking and, you know, conniving and so on, but how often when everything ends happily at the end of a Shakespeare comedy, it ends literally with a dance, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Also, it's very cinematic, you know, and can get everybody on the stage.
Yeah, for sure.
So unless you have anything else you want to say about Emma, we can move on to The Way Back.
Okay.
Into The Way Back Machine. And now we have to come forward to the present day for The Way Back, which is a Ben Affleck vehicle. And when I saw it, the theater was packed. This was right before we all had to go hide in our houses.
Well, let me talk about it in this respect. Usually we like to peg a film in terms of genre. And, you know, we could talk for hours about that in terms of genre expectations and so on. And, you know, is it fair to the film, you know, to put it in a box, as I say? You know, it's this kind of movie or that kind of movie. But you do sometimes get a film where, you know, whether you like it or don't like it, one of the interesting points for discussion is it may not readily fit into just a single box. And I'm getting at that it's this genre or that one. And sometimes, even if the film doesn't entirely work, it's interesting just by way of how it's sort of, you know, a genre mashup or a melding of genres. And this is very directly the case with The Way Back, because it's both an inspirational sports movie, and we know all the cliches of that genre, right? But it's also simultaneously a recovery movie. And that's what we could talk about by way of, you know, how it really functions as both, and how well it works is maybe something we could go into. But the fact that one of the things that kept me interested, always interested watching this, as it sort of segued from one to the other and back again by way of two basic genres, I thought, you know, there aren't really that many films that do that as categorically as this one does, that it really is in a, like with one foot in each genre.
Yes, I would agree with you. I can see it as a sports movie and a recovery movie. I'm not sure which show people were showing up for.
Well, see, that's part of the conundrum, and it, you know, it has to be something we just speculate about as to, you know, some of the marketing, I mean, the trailers and the print ads and so on, it most often, you know, would have action scenes as in, you know, the guys on the basketball court kind of stuff, the coach on the sidelines. I mean, those are obvious ways to sell it as a sports movie. But then the moment you start to focus at all on the character, who's, you know, an alcoholic, then it immediately throws you into the other genre, other mode, that it's going to be about his recovery or attempted recovery. And so that's an interesting point of discussion, you know, as to what pulls people in. Now, in a case like this one, Ben Affleck's a big enough movie star that some people go to see it just because it's Ben Affleck. But as to other people, how would they respond there? In other words, let's say, and this is a very stereotypical way to put it, but let's say somebody hears about the film and they think, oh, I like sports movies, and they get pulled in that way, and then they realize it's actually much more somber and you know, sobering in its own way, by way of then as a recovery story. Would the audience feel not exactly gulled, not exactly as if they'd been, you know, tricked or something, but might well think, gee, this isn't quite the film I was expecting. What do you think there? Because, you know, a lot has to do with audience expectations. We do sort of have, whether fairly or not, preconceived notions that it'll be in this genre or that one. But if you go in expecting one genre and then you realize it's segueing to a very different genre when you think about it, you know, as to whether that works in the film, but also in terms of your expectations and your preferences. I mean, do you want both those things in the same movie?
I think the audiences were probably more pleased who went in looking for a story about recovery. And I suspect that that's a lot of the people who went to see this because Ben Affleck has been so vocal recently about his own recovery. So I think a lot of people went thinking, well, this is him kind of showing us what he has been going through. And in terms of the strengths, I think Ben Affleck's performance was terrific. I think in terms of going to see a sports movie, you would probably be a little disappointed, not that it doesn't include stuff about basketball, but I think that's just the frame. You know, I don't think it's really about that as much as it's about this just is the vehicle by which we get to watch him struggle with a situation that's out of his control.
Well, yeah, because Affleck has talked a lot about his own problems with drinking and so on. And so you're right. In terms of the public awareness of Ben Affleck, enough people would know that already and that he drew on his own experiences in making the film. So that would be the audience coming in expecting the recovery movie because, in effect, that's why he's making it, right? But some of the other marketing was, you know, really pitching it a bit more by way of, you know, selling it as a sports story. And that's where, I mean, I would like to think that an audience can be pulled in expecting one genre and then be happy to realize it's a little richer than that, you know what I mean, that it's straddling genres. But it's just a matter of musing on my part, wondering, you know, if you go in expecting one genre and then you get something that's a bit different. Because even the title, like The Way Back, I mean, that sort of tips the balance towards recovery movie. But by the same token, when you think about inspirational sports movies, how often you would have, like, the struggling high school team, right? And the coach might be struggling very, but you know what? They really work hard, and it's an American film, and you know they're going to, like, you know, win on that last basket. You know, I mean, you know, this movie has the smarts and the honesty not to be that formulaic. But how often we've seen films that are that formulaic, right? That, you know, The Way Back, that, you know, we will, you know, improve the team. We're going to win the championship, and the audience will cheer at the end before the end credits. This film pretty quickly establishes that it's really, you know, push come to shove, going to rely more on the recovery genre mode than the other, and that the sports story is, as you put it very astutely, is more of like a framework, you know, through which he will attempt his own recovery.
So any other pluses in the movie that you want to mention, or do you want to talk immediately about the minuses?
Well, in terms of the pluses, I thought one of them is the fact that Jack is not always as immediately and completely likable as protagonists tend to be in films. And I think there are maybe a few reasons for that. One is just simply with the nature of his alcoholism that, you know, he can be a mean drunk, you know, and it doesn't shy away from showing, you know, the really depressing aspects of alcoholism. You know, I can appreciate the honesty of that, and the fact that his personality, you know, certainly when drunk, but even just his basic personality, sometimes has a kind of edge to it a bit. He's got a quote in the film where he, and in fact this sort of startles the Catholic high school where he goes to work in terms of what they expect from coaches. He's got some foul language, right? He's got, like, you know, a sort of potty mouth that way, and it certainly startles the, you know, the Catholic hierarchy at the high school that hires him to be the coach, but also startles the players, and I would think even like the movie theater audience a bit, that, you know, he's got a kind of rude quality, kind of, you know, direct quality, but in a rude sense. And then there's one quote in the film where he's, you know, talking about what he wants to do with the team and push them, motivate them, where he says, "I will not coach a team that has been out-toughed." Now, you would think in an inspirational sports movie, that would be a good kind of, like, you know, tough, no-nonsense coach thing to say, that, you know, we're going to play rough and we're not going to let anyone push us around, so on. But the way the quote is handled in this film, it not only ruffles the feathers of the Catholic school administrators, but I would think even with the audience a little bit, just thinking, you know, Jack, you know, because of the alcoholism and maybe just some other character traits, he's got a kind of hard edge to him sometimes that makes him a less than perfect protagonist. You know, I'm getting at, even if he weren't afflicted with the alcoholism, that he's got a bit of an edge to him there. I mean, what do you think of that? Because he really does it. And Affleck is not afraid to make him unlikable in some of those scenes.
No, he definitely has an edge. So my last question for you, because we're running out of time, is do you see an Oscar nomination for Ben Affleck from this movie?
Well, first of all, will we see the Oscars again? As we speak, the whole model is changing. And I've been reading articles recently about, you know, what's Hollywood going to do in terms of release schedule and in terms of the Academy Awards. Should they consider films that, you know, had theatrical release early this year? Surely they will, but can they consider films that are now being, you know, directly streamed rather than in movie theaters? So I won't speculate further. They're just simply say that it's like an open-ended consideration right now. And so I would think, though, to the extent that in this very unconventional, very unusual year in so many ways, by the end of it, if you get to that short list of actors who might get an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor, I would think Ben Affleck could well be on it for The Way Back. What do you think?
I think he's a definite contender. But I think that also
is
to the end of our time here. So, you know, be sure to check some of these movies out online, because a lot of things are available that wouldn't have been available this soon. And also check out our other programs at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.